This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Nocticadia, written by Carrie Lake, performed by Aaron Shedlock and Stella Hunter.
Content warning. This book contains explicit sex scenes and graphic violence. The male main character is a morally gray character who exacts revenge for the murder of his brother by infecting his victims with parasites. The symptoms of the infection are detailed in the book. Prologue. Dracadia Island, October 12th, 1753. Lord Adderley had seen plenty of death in his lifetime. As Commodore for the Royal Navy, its cloying scent had clogged the back of his throat more times than he could recall. He'd felt its cold, vaporous breath skim across his flesh, with a longing that would have made most men shiver. Lord Adderley did not fear death. Some had even dared to accuse him of welcoming it. Yet as he stared across the turbulent stretch of wintry sea, toward an ominous black smoke that rose from the surrounding fog, a shiver of dread coiled down his neck. The order to have his men row back from whence they'd come sat heavy on his tongue when, in the distance, the island's shadowy silhouette split through the mist, an arched rock formation which loomed on the horizon like a sleeping dragon. Halfway between the coast of Massachusetts and French-settled Acadia, the small Dracadia Island had long been a source of contention, a stretch of land that one could argue had belonged to the British. It hadn't been until most of the Acadians had mysteriously abandoned the island that it had been annexed as a province of Massachusetts. Lord Adderley had led the charge himself, prepared for battle, in the event the French returned to reclaim the village of Emberwick on the north end. It had never come to pass. The British who'd settled there instead had eventually come to suffer a series of misfortunes and had fled the island, leaving Dracadia abandoned once more. Of course, rumors had spread. Some had blamed the indigenous Kuanachki tribe, who'd sequestered themselves in the southern mountains, for having roused their heathen gods. Whatever the cause, speculations of bad spirits and inexplicable maladies had kept most from the enticement of land ownership on Dracadia. As a result, the island had failed to house any more than the heretics who'd been exiled there, the worst offenders of the holy doctrines. Lord Adderley did not avert his gaze from the path ahead as the shore broke through the fog and the water grew shallower. Over the devastated landscape, black birds clustered in thick flocks. Murders. The ravens, whose presence had long stirred fears of evil. Lord Adderley had watched their kind follow men to war with the promise of carrion. The circling birds could only be an omen, a sign of death.
"Dear God,"
Lieutenant Crist said, where he sat beside the Commodore.
"Is it the savages, my lord?"
"No." While the Commodore answered assuredly, the truth was he didn't know. He'd fought all sorts of savages, and while they battled with unconventional fervor, they were hardly inherently evil.
"Rumors speak of sharpened black stones for teeth, and eyes like wolves in the darkness,"
Crist prattled on.
"Perhaps you give equal merit to stories of sea monsters and sirens."
"Of course not, my lord, but the men who speak of such things are of sound mind, good Christian men."
The Commodore had little doubt of their integrity, but to offer the truth behind their voyage would have sparked panic, perhaps even mutiny. For, unbeknownst to Lieutenant Crist, they had been summoned there by correspondence from the church after several clergymen had failed to return with three accused witches. Under the care of Dr. Jack Sterling, the three women had been ordered to trial in Massachusetts proper. There had been suspicion that the good doctor had gone mad, possessed by the very demons he had been charged to bleed out of the women months ago. The Commodore had heard horrific stories of patients with black veins who'd been left to hang, bleeding by their feet. Those whose mouths and eyes had been sewn shut and tongues removed. The Commodore and his men had been sent to investigate the claims, and given the sinister warnings in the distance, he feared what they'd find there. Closer, the boat tottered across relentless waves, and as shadows lifted to reveal the charred husks of trees, Lord Adderley inhaled deeply, swallowing back the greasy scent of burnt meat on the air, the familiar scent of death. Six of his men jumped from the boat, dragging the small vessel through the shallows, and once ashore, Lord Adderley set foot on the unhallowed grounds to which he'd sworn never to return. He swept his gaze over the impossible destruction, contemplating what, in God's name, could have accomplished such a feat. An entire island burned to ash. The fog around them thickened, and Lord Adderley frowned as it settled between them and the seared forest. Lieutenant Crist strode up alongside him.
"Forgive me for saying so, my lord, but I've no inclination to venture beyond the shore."
"Hold your tongue," Lord Adderley spoke low, "lest you long to invite mutiny."
"My lord,"
one of his men shouted, and the Commodore turned to see him pointing toward the trees. Lord Adderley followed the path of the man's finger toward shadows within the fog, a figure moving toward them. The sharp clank of his men readying their weapons echoed around them, but when the white vapor parted for a young boy, perhaps only 12 years of age, Lord Adderley stepped forward.
"Lower your weapons."
Dressed in the robes of a young acolyte, the boy stumbled toward them, his skin covered in black soot and robes stained with what was undoubtedly blood. Before reaching the Commodore and his men, the acolyte tumbled to the sand. As Lord Adderley strode toward him and lowered to one knee alongside the boy, Crist knelt at the boy's feet, where small bleeding wounds on their top suggested they'd been impaled by something sharp.
"Careful, my lord. We've no idea to what he's been exposed."
Cuts, bruises, and patches of glistening flesh where skin had been peeled back marked signs of unspeakable abuse. The sight of him brought the Commodore's own son to mind, and he fought tears as he took in the acolyte's condition.
"What happened here?"
"Blackness," the boy whispered on a ragged breath. The sky turned to blackness. All of them burned."
Lord Adderley brushed the sticky, blood-stained hair from the boy's face.
"Who did this?"
Through the exhaustion that darkened the boy's eyes lay a flicker of fear.
"They commanded the flames, and the flames did their bidding."
"Who commanded the flames? Witches?"
One slow blink, and the boy exhaled. When he breathed in, his chest rattled like coins in a tin cup.
"Not witches. Worms. Black worms spilling from the mouths of madness."
A hush fell over the men, the boy's words raising the hair on the back of the Commodore's neck. Crist moved closer and, leaning in, whispered,
"The boy does not seem well, my lord. He is speaking of evil."
Ignoring his lieutenant, the Commodore placed a hand on the boy's bony shoulder.
"You are the only one left."
"All of them burned."
Lifting his gaze to Lieutenant Crist, the Commodore kept his voice level in spite of his nerves.
"We'll take the boy and return to the ship, now."
"You cannot leave."
A wet, barky cough sent a trickle of blood from the acolyte's mouth.
"They will not allow it."
The Commodore frowned at the boy and pushed to his feet. He ordered two of his men to carry him back to the ship.
"My lord!"
The coxswain cried out with an edge of panic, and the Commodore turned to see him stumbling through the sand toward them.
"The boat! The boat is gone! It's gone!"
"Fear not, my lord."
Over the din of panic, as the other men caught on to the bizarre disappearance, the boy's weakened, almost ghostly voice reached the Commodore's ears.
"Your boat was never there to begin."
"I do not understand your words, boy."
"You and your men arrived with the priests days ago."
Heavy wheezing filled each pause, as the boy seemed to struggle with breath.
"You are sick with delirium. I was summoned here by correspondence from the church itself."
Eyelids hooded, the boy's dry and cracked lips stretched to a slight smile.
"You are dreaming now, but soon you will wake to the sound of crackling fire and find you and your men tied to stakes. Your flesh will be seared, and your pain and misery will echo for eternity."
The boy's eyes fluttered shut, and he let out a hiss of air before his body turned limp in his officer's arms. Cold dreg clawed at Lord Adderley's belly, the scent of burning fat and skin clogging his throat again. He closed his eyes, finding solace in the pitch blackness, and when the first sounds of agony pierced the air, he dared not open them.
Chapter 1. Lilia. Present Day. God, that stench. Two crisp spam sizzled in a pan as I held my arm to my nose. The popping sound of fatty meat was loud enough to carry over Jean Valjean's heartfelt plea to Javert from Les Miserables playing in the theater below our apartment. I'd accidentally burned the thinner pieces while peeling the potatoes, and there was no salvaging it at that point. Whatever finesse my mother had always had in the kitchen had failed to grace my genetics. I hated cooking the canned crap, but Mom had developed a weird craving for meat lately, and we'd run out of the thin round steak she'd come to like eating rare. I couldn't help but wonder if her strange requests might have been her body trying to get better. I hoped so, anyway. Watching her devour rare meat with the blood running out of the corners of her mouth had me feeling like a spectator in a gory episode of Hostile Planet, an appetite-withering sight. Particularly since my mother had never really been much of a meat eater anyway. Spam was a far cry from steak, but my stepdad Connor, if I could even call him that, hadn't worked a couple days, which left us short on grocery money. "Bee!" I called out for my younger half-sister, the nickname short for Beatrix, and tossed the charred spam onto awaiting plates. "Do you check on Mama like I asked?" "Oh, shit!" The thud of footfalls followed her curse, and with a smirk I shook my head. At 12 years old, about 4 years younger than me, she carried a lot more responsibility than most girls her age. Both of us did. Mama's illness had gotten worse. So much worse, and the fact that she refused to see a doctor about it only put more pressure on Bea and me to navigate the progression of her strange symptoms ourselves. While Mama still seemed to have her wits about her, there were moments, terrifying moments, like the nights she'd tell me that evil men were coming for me, the nights she'd be covered in sweat, her eyes glowing with unseen horrors. Monsters, she called those invisible tormentors. But in her mind, they were as real as the deep black circles beneath her eyes. Although as horrible as it was to say, with her sickly distorted spine, silvery glowing eyes, and deep protruding bones, she'd begun to look like the very monsters of which she spoke. Praying had never really been my thing, but I'd done an awful lot of aimless pleading on my knees over the last few weeks, and if God existed, he sure as hell didn't offer much hope. As I spooned the last glob of mashed potatoes for Bea, a knock at the door halted my plating. Frowning, I quietly placed the pan back onto the stovetop and wiped my hands onto a nearby kitchen towel. With cautious steps, I padded toward the hallway and peered at the entry door. Another hard thud jerked my muscles, and the audacity of whatever was behind that obnoxious racket heated my blood. I tromped toward the door and through the peephole spied a man I didn't recognize. Deep-set, beady eyes, a scar at his left eye, and an oddly crooked nose, like he'd been in one too many fights, made him look like a walking mugshot. One thing I'd learned from living in a city like Covington, you didn't answer the door to strangers, particularly ones who looked like criminals. He pounded against the door again, and I ground my teeth with annoyance. "Yeah?" I called through the barrier. "What do you want?" At first he didn't answer, and I watched him look around toward the hallway. Something about him, those dark eyes I'd only caught a glimpse of, and the smirk of his lips, sent a crawling chill beneath my skin. What a creep. I glanced at the door's deadbolt, making sure it was engaged. Unfortunately, the apartment didn't have the greatest or most robust locks.
"I'm a friend of Connor's,"
he finally said.
"Is he here?"
"No."
"Any idea when he'll be back?"
Studying his face proved challenging, since the guy seemed to refuse to look up. "Look, I don't..." At the sound of a piercing scream, my spine snapped straight, and I swung my attention toward the back rooms. Abandoning the weirdo at the front door, I dashed across the apartment toward the sliver of light shining beneath the bathroom door. Light. The first sign that something was wrong. Mama had grown to hate the light, said it hurt her eyes. "Mama, no!" A whisper of fear spiraled down the back of my neck at what I recognized as Bea screaming at my mother on the other side of the door, and I pushed through into the brightly lit bathroom. Mama stood alongside the tub, making a strange growling sound while water splashed onto the floor. Two pink-socked feet kicked out over the edge of the basin. "Oh, God, Bea!" Icy pulses of adrenaline took over as I rushed toward them and knocked my mother aside into the wool. The moment she was released, Bee shot up out of the water, her upper half sopping wet, and she let out a barky cough. "What the hell are you doing?" I shouted at my mother, whose eyes gave off an iridescent flicker in the light. On a screech, my mother barreled forward again, knocking into me and pushed Bee back into the water. Panic exploded through my muscles, my body no longer moving at my will but on instinct. I grabbed my mother by the hair, throwing her off Bee. A chunk of dull red locks sat in my palm as my mother slipped from my grasp and fell backward against the toilet. The slippery floor had her scrambling to get to her feet again, and I yanked Bee out of the bathtub, sliding on wet tiles as I pushed her toward the door. Once out in the hallway, I hauled the door shut after us, tugging the knob to keep it closed. "Go to your room, lock the door, and do not come out until I tell you," I commanded. She coughed and sniffled. "I was just trying to keep her from drinking the water, and she attacked me." The door thumped and jerked my arm as Mama fought from the other side. "She's one of them! She's one of them!" Mama screamed through the barrier. "Don't let her get away! She'll tell them I'm here!" "Go, now, lock the door. Don't open it, no matter what you hear." I braced my feet against the wall and leaned back into the pull of the knob, holding the door closed as Bee scampered toward her bedroom. After another minute of fighting to keep her contained, the thumping stopped. Mama's screams silenced. With heaving breaths, I eased my muscles and straightened, no longer feeling resistance from the other side. "Mama?" I spoke low through the door, hoping she'd give a coherent answer, an explanation for what the hell just happened. She'd spoken of someone coming after her before, but had never projected those paranoid thoughts onto me or Bee. Nothing. But the cloying scent that had been companion to my mother's illness seemed stronger than usual. Thick and sticky, it clogged my throat, and I raised the back of my palm to my face in a poor effort to stifle the odor. Over the past few months, Mama's sweet floral scent, a comforting smell I'd known my whole life, had somehow faded under the weight of that unfamiliar stink. Now it was all I breathed. Ignoring the urge to gag, I turned the knob and entered the bathroom. Mama lay slung over the edge of the tub, her face submerged in the water. "Mama!" I sprinted toward her, and on a splash of water, she swung around, screaming again. I reached for her arm, but she swung out first, plowing the back of her knuckles against my cheek. Pain zapped my bones on a burst of floating stars that wobbled my vision. I shook off the dizziness when she swung out again and ducked. That time, she failed to connect as her hands flailed in a fit of rage. Gathering her arms in a tight grip, I dug my nails into her frail bones, but a sharp sting pierced my hand where she sank her teeth into my flesh. "Ouch, shit!" I pushed her off me and she slipped, arms thrashing around as she fell backward into the tub. When I tried to pull her up, her hands reached out for me and gripped my shirt, wrenching me toward the water. A rush of fluids shot up into my sinuses on a deep burn, her grip unrelenting as she held me underwater. Panic crystallized my muscles. Water splashed with her frenzied kicking and grappling of my neck. I reached out for the only thing I could get my hands on in the melee. Palm to her throat, I squeezed just enough to lessen her grip, and I held her there as my face breached the surface of the water on a gasped breath. She yanked me down again, dunking my face underwater with her. I squeezed her throat harder, and once again she loosened her hold. Each searing lungful of air scorched my throat and shot out of me on a coughing fit. Frantic, she scratched at the back of my neck, trying to pull me under again. "Mama, please!" Breath weak in my lungs, I could hardly push out the words as my muscles locked around my chest. My legs slid across the tiles as I wrangled her arms to keep her from pulling me. Submerged beneath the water, my mother opened her mouth, eyes wide in a shocked expression. As if her fight relented, she stilled while a haunting resolution flashed over her face, one that tickled the back of my neck. I pushed away and stood over the tub, no longer holding her, but she didn't bother to emerge. Surely the air had withered in her lungs by that point. Surely she needed oxygen. "Come on, get up." I lurched for her arm to pull her up, but halted when, from her mouth, a long, skinny, fibrous creature slithered out past her lips and into the water. Three more tumbled after it, two from her nose. A scream shook out of me, and limbs frozen with horror, I watched as the worms wriggled over the tub's porcelain floor and forged a path through the water to gather at the drain holes. At least two dozen more poured free, forcing her mouth and nostrils wide. More still after that. They all wriggled toward the plugged drain. My breaths arrived in small panting gasps as I watched the horror, until blackness consumed me. Chapter 2. Lilia. 4 years later. Lilia! A voice cut through the void. I blinked my eyes open and found myself hunched over the drain of a yellowing sink. Earth to Lilia! The familiar voice said again. Confused, I turned to find my co-worker Jada standing alongside me, and I pushed up from the sink I'd been cleaning. It was in the haze of confusion that I remembered scrubbing the sink, during which I'd caught wind of a strange but familiar scent, like rot and dirt. So heavy was the odor that I'd fallen into memories again. A sheepish grin tugged at my lips and I cleared my throat. Sorry, I must have spaced out. It happens sometimes. Something would trigger thoughts, and those thoughts had me slipping into the most horrific memory of my life. One that never failed to pull me under so deep that I lost sight of my own reality. It had been 4 years since my mother's death, yet I remembered every detail. The scents, the sounds, the cold. I was just saying I'm going to work on the office next door. Forearm across her nose, Jada coughed. I don't know what the hell the last person in here ate, but that does not smell healthy. So I'm going to leave all these latrines to you, she said on a chuckle. Still spacey, I grabbed the rag I'd dropped on the floor and tossed it into the sudsy bucket beside me. The usual nausea gurgled in my belly, and I tried to hide the shakiness in my arms by busying my hands, wiping them on my scrubs and swiping up the bucket for the next sink. You're the sweetest. Snorting, she stepped toward the door but paused. You sure you're okay? You look a little pale. Fine. Totally fine. I just fell deep into thoughts. Real deep, from the looks of it. Seriously, you don't mind if I start on the other room? I just figured the two of us could get out early if we hustle. Half smiling, I shrugged. I don't mind. In truth, I hated cleaning the bathrooms, the patient rooms, the offices, but I suspected it was the closest I'd ever get to working in an actual hospital. The dream of medical research seemed to fade every day, my body growing weary of life. At my age, I should have been finishing up my bachelor's degree and trying to decide whether to take the MCAT or GRE, but with as few classes as I was able to squeeze in at the community college around work, it'd be a decade before I reached that point in my schooling. Thanks, girl. Early pregnancy and sewage do not mix. The bathrooms in the hospital's basement reeked, as a general rule, but the stench on the air right then was particularly potent. I got it, I said, waving her on. Get out of here. I don't need to be cleaning your puke up next. Chuckling, she slipped out the door, and alone, I exhaled a long, shaky breath. Hands braced at either side of the sink, I closed my eyes and attempted to clear my mind. Screams, black worms, vacant eyes. With a shake of my head, I buried those thoughts in the shadows of my mind, refusing to let them consume me. No, not tonight. What sounded like the faint plink of water reached my ears, and I opened my eyes to the reflected stalls behind me in the mirror. At the very last stall, I spotted something I hadn't noticed when I first walked in, the soles of socked feet beneath the door. I spun around, my heart clenching with the shock of the discovery. Those were definitely feet beneath the door. Is someone there? I asked, knowing damn well that someone was, in fact, there. Above the feet, I caught sight of the hem of the familiar hospital gown that every patient wore. Patients who shouldn't have been using the basement bathroom assigned to staff. A faint splashing sound reached my ears again. Given the position of the feet, the person likely wasn't indisposed right then, but they could have been vomiting. Do you need some help? Because I can run and get someone if you do. I hiked my finger over my shoulder as if they could have seen me. No answer. I tiptoed closer,
Are you sick? Still no answer. I finally reached the stall door, peering through the skinny cracks. Long, straggly red hair lay draped across a patient gown, half opened enough to reveal a pale, mottled back and white underwear. An uneven purplish tone colored the limbs that I could see, particularly the leg and hand. My first thought was liver mortis, but I pushed that thought aside. A stinging dryness settled in my throat, and I swallowed a gulp. Please just be okay. I gave a slight knock, noting the minute swing of the unlocked door, and hoped the person would volley back an undignified protest to my prying. They didn't say a word. I pushed open the door. The person's head rested just below the seat inside the toilet, those straggled bits of hair hiding the face. I reached out a trembling hand and gripped a slender shoulder, tugging just enough to totter her to the side. She rolled onto her back, knocking her head on the wall of the stall, and the moment her hair fell away from her face, I stumbled backward. The familiar, milky glow of my mother's eyes stared back at me. Movement flickered in my periphery, and a rush of air flew out of me when I snapped my attention there and just caught sight of a long, black, slithery object slipping down the toilet bowl. An icy fear gripped my muscles. I blinked, triple blinked. I swung my attention back toward my mother. Another black, slithery form glided past purple lips down her plum-colored cheek to the tiled floor. It wriggled straight for me. A scream tore from my chest as I jumped backward, tumbling onto my ass. The worm came at me, fast and determined. Before it reached me, though, it slipped down the floor drain, halfway between me and my mother's lifeless body. The crash of the door sent another shudder through me, and I jolted upright as Jada came bounding into the restroom. Lilia, you all right? I heard you scream. Nose stinging with the threat of tears, I shook my head, unable to form the words. Frowning, she stepped cautiously toward me, eyes scanning the room. What's wrong?
We need to call someone,
I managed, pointing toward the stall.
Call someone?
Expression carved in confusion. She turned toward where I pointed.
Lilia, are you okay?
I swung my attention back toward the stall to find nothing, not a single trace that anyone had been there. Humiliation burned in my cheeks as the shock of reality settled over me. My mind scrambled for a reason, something to steal away the possibility that I'd lost my damn mind. Jada stepped over my legs and cracked the door to the next stall, jumping back on a scream.
What the hell?
My pulse hammered.
Had she seen them too?
Burying her nose in her arm, she gagged and stepped back.
Hang on. I'm gonna call someone down. Just hang on.
Frowning, I pushed up from the floor as she exited the bathroom and peered into the stall next to the one where I'd seen my mother. A ball of dark fur with a long, naked tail floated on the surface of the toilet water. A rat. That explained the smell, at least. Heaving breaths sawed out of me as I leaned against the wall across from the stall and slid to the floor again. A heavy weight weakened my legs. A numbing cold pulsed through my limbs and chest. No doubt I was having a panic attack, because a cold, clammy feeling settled over me like ice water filling my lungs. And I was pretty sure that if I hadn't sat down, I'd have passed out. Eyes closed, I breathed through my nose in counts of four. Over the incessant thud of blood pounding in my ear, I could hear Jada's calm voice as she made the call to maintenance. A simmering nausea shot up from my stomach into my throat, but I swallowed back the urge to throw up. Acids burned in my sinuses, and I clenched my eyes tighter, breathing harder through my nose. Daring to lift my lids, I stared at the empty stall, hating myself for having slipped into another episode in front of my coworker. On unsteady muscles, I pushed to my feet again, and thankfully the sickness from before settled from my throat back down to my belly. Breathing through my nose helped. At my neck, I clutched the small vial of my mother's ashes that I wore, hanging from her old rosary she used to keep in her pocket. It was a silly superstition, my mother had told me once. She'd always worn a ring of my grandmother's strung on a necklace. When I asked why she wore it all the time, she'd told me that the dead never harmed those who carried something that belonged to them. I didn't even believe in God, but my mother did, and a part of me felt compelled to keep the rosary for that reason. My muscles flinched when the door flew open again. Jada stepped just inside, keeping her distance. I called maintenance. They're on their way down. You okay? Her reassuring voice reminded me of my mother's. At 23 years old, she was only a few years older than I was, but life seemed to have aged both of us.
I think so. Just a little rattled. No, honey, I mean, are you okay?
I knew what she meant. Everything seemed to make me jittery nowadays. Who knew what had triggered the episode that time? Maybe the smell. Maybe I'd seen the rat and processed it as something entirely different. Wasn't the first time that had happened. Jada had witnessed a couple incidents when I'd seen something that wasn't there. I'll be fine. The three words that had become my mantra in the last 4 years. I'll be fine. For the most part, I had been fine. Except for the times when something had triggered flashbacks. Or I'd seen the occasional hallucination of my mother. Was I okay, though? I guess that remained to be seen.
Chapter 3. Lilia. Riding the subway after work sucked. Riding the subway after having seen my dead mother at work was downright unnerving. Although Jada had urged me to leave an hour earlier than usual, I'd stayed a bit longer just so I didn't saddle her with all the work. I'd never bothered to mention the hallucination to her, even if she was more friend than coworker. And the times I did talk about my mother's death, I never bothered to mention the black worms in her mouth either. Mostly because I had a bad feeling they weren't real either. According to Bee's dad, Connor, my mother had slit her wrists that night. The story went that Bee had eventually come out of her room to find me passed out on the bathroom floor and Mom in the tub with her wrists slashed. She'd run back into her room and called Connor, and by the time he'd arrived, she was hiding under her bed, shaking and muttering to herself. The story had a plot hole, though. A void that had never filled after years of trying to remember the details of that night. I couldn't recall my mom having cut her wrists. Surely I'd have mentally clocked such a gruesome sight in the timeline. When I'd insisted that I'd seen the worms spill from her mouth, though, Connor had denied their presence and produced the coroner's report. There, plain as day, her cause of death had stood out from every other gory detail. Severe blood loss due to suicide. That was when I'd first spiraled into a dark place where I couldn't trust myself. A place where reality and nightmares blurred. I'd followed up with our family doctor a few months later to ask about the worms. And he'd pretty much argued with me, telling me he'd never heard of such a thing. Which made sense, I guessed, if I'd made them up. A number of Google searches had failed to produce anything about the worms, too. And every medical journal I'd read on parasites had lacked the complications and progression of symptoms that I'd noted throughout my mother's illness. I had no choice other than to accept that I'd imagined them. Trauma could do shitty things to a person's head, after all. By the time I finally left work, I felt like I'd run a mental marathon. Still didn't entirely have my wits about me, which made the subway feel different tonight. Scarier. At just after midnight, the only route open was the Red Line, and aside from smelling like piss, it was sparse. The only folks out and about were the junkies and bar hoppers, a few of whom sat zoned out or sleeping. Covington wasn't the worst city in the country, but it certainly wasn't the safest. The potent stench of urine, stagnant with the July heat, was only a minor distraction, though, to the turbulence still churning in my head. The problem was I didn't sleep much. A vicious cycle, really. I suffered horrible nightmares that kept me awake for more hours than the average person. It meant that I sometimes saw things. And sometimes the things I saw made it hard to determine whether I was awake or asleep. Eyes closed, I took deep breaths. Clutching the rosary. When I finally opened them again, I caught the leering stare of an older man across the aisle from me. Had to be in his late 40s, judging by the speckles of gray in his beard and hair. Pale white skin told me he didn't get much sun. Only one other woman in the car, perhaps 60, lay passed out in the corner. The other dozen scattered about the car were men.
My social anxiety came courtesy of my mother, who'd always shunned the notion that people were inherently good. In her eyes, everyone was a serial killer until proven otherwise, and somehow, a small bit of that paranoia had manifested in me over the years. I released the rosary and slipped my hand into my pocket for the knife that I carried everywhere, even to bed. One I'd bought for myself a while back when I'd decided to work the night shift. As if the older man sensed my unease, he lowered his gaze toward the pendant at my neck. Strung by a black beaded chain, the ashes inside made up the purest form of my mother. All of the disease that killed her burned away. The urge to clutch it again, to protect my mother from his stares, tugged at me, but instead I looked away, although I still felt the man's gaze on me. The voice overhead announced my stop was next. Relieved, I pushed up from my seat, and without looking at the guy, I hustled down the aisle as the train rolled to a stop. The moment the door opened, I dashed out onto the empty platform.
Hey!
A raspy, gravelly voice called after me.
Hey, girl!
Stupid drunks. I dealt with them at least 3 times a week, and I just wasn't in the mood tonight. I ignored him and kept on toward the staircase ahead, my whole body shaking, knuckles burning with the grip of my blade inside my pocket. A click of the button popped the blade open and offered a small bit of comfort where I could feel it pressed through the fabric against my thigh.
Hey, girl!
The voice was closer than before, but I didn't dare turn to look at him.
Stop!
Heart thundering in my chest, I ran for the stairs, and the moment I hit the first step, a firm grip of my arm jolted my muscles. Twisting around showed the man from the subway, and I swiped the blade out of my pocket, holding it with a trembling hand between us. I suggest you let me go. Now. He did, at the same time lifting my canvas bag up.
You left this?
Eyes flicking to the bag and back to him. I stood dumbfounded. The tension in my muscles loosened, and I let out a shaky breath. I snatched up the bag, tucking the blade back into my pocket. Thanks. The man's bushy brow winged up.
Stay safe.
At that, he hobbled off, back toward the platform. Once out of sight, I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. Get it together, Lilia. The flashing marquee sign of the Luminette Theater cast a bright light across the sidewalk as I made my way down Prather Street to the unremarkable door just past the theater's entrance. The apartment complex, where I'd basically grown up most of my life, situated above the theater, had been built in the early 20s, when theater was booming in the city. The building itself was something of a landmark in Covington, the place where the first known serial killer in Massachusetts had left his victim, a well-known actress back then, carved up in her dressing room. In spite of its infamy and history, the building hadn't been well kept over the years. Just wasn't enough money to properly restore it, I guessed. I climbed the narrow staircase, their tired bones creaking under my boots. Not even the heavy scent of mold and mothballs could erase the odor of piss still clogging my nose. When I finally reached the apartment, the sound of voices sent a pulsing dread through me, particularly when I recognized one of them belonging to Connor's friend, Angelo. He'd shown up about 4 years ago and stuck around like an ugly mole on my ass, the kind with a cancerous core.
I don't know, man. Those guys have ties to the cartel,
Connor said through the door.
I got my daughter to think about.
My mom had gotten in touch with Connor for Bee, mostly before she'd passed. For the first 2 years of Bee's life, he'd lived with us until Mom had kicked him out and he'd ended up in New York, living with roommates in some crappy neighborhood. A couple years before Mom got sick, he'd agreed to move back in with us to help out and attempt to establish a relationship with his daughter. Considering I wasn't an adult at the time she died, we would have probably gotten thrown into foster care since my mom didn't have any family that I knew of. Connor was an absolute jerk at times. But at least he'd kept us together, for the most part.
It's a fucking grand. Look around.
Angelo spat back.
You're not exactly living the high life here.
Sometime after Mom had died, the two of them went into some covert business together that Connor claimed was nothing more than selling scrap metal they'd scrounged. I didn't buy that for 1 second. Not since the time I'd watched the two of them beat the shit out of a guy in the back alley of our apartment. Anytime I brought it up, though, an argument would ensue, always ending with Connor telling me to mind my own business. I didn't like it. and I sure as hell didn't like Angelo. The guy was a creep sundae with a rotten, moldy cherry. Frowning, I entered the small apartment and found Angelo kicked back in one of the kitchen chairs while Connor chugged a beer beside him. Connor straightened, likely surprised to see me home a half hour earlier than usual.
Hey, Lil, what's going on?
Just a few years shy of 40, Connor was a mess, with his grease-stained hands and shirts courtesy of the auto shop where he'd worked the last 6 years. His friend, on the other hand, came a bit tidier, but carried an odor that reminded me of freshly churned dirt mixed with a hardware store. As he sipped his beer, Angelo's beady black eyes tracked me to the opposite corner of the room where I kept my distance. Had a maintenance issue at work. Glancing between Connor and Angelo, I pulled my bag up higher onto my arm. Found a dead rat in one of the restrooms.
Nice.
Connor snorted and downed another long swill.
Surprised you didn't bring it home for dinner,
Angelo said, his lip only half curved with a smile. Had I known you were going to be here, I would have. His lips twitched. Angelo didn't like to be challenged, particularly if it made him look like a fool.
Think your daddy needs to do something about that smart mouth of yours.
The implication in his words had me swallowing back my repulsion.
Easy.
Connor, obtuse as ever, gave a light kick to Angelo's chair just as the brute raised his beer to his mouth. Fluid splashed out onto his lap, and the murderous glance he sent Connor seemed to have my stepdad shifting on his feet.
You don't have to be a dick.
Manners is a foreign language to assholes, I blurted before I could stop myself. Unfortunately, Connor didn't have the balls to stand up to his friend if he retaliated, so spouting off at the mouth wasn't exactly wise on my part. Angelo sailed a scathing glare my way, but didn't bother to say anything more, thankfully. From the countertop beside him, Connor reached for a paper plate that held a single slice of pizza.
Save some dinner for you, Lil, if you're hungry.
He tossed the plate onto the table across from Angelo, the impact knocking the cheese off to the side in such a way that the sight of it withered my appetite. Not that I'd have eaten much anyway. Not when those worms played on repeat inside my head. The phone rang, interrupting Angelo's death stare, and Connor answered. After a few clipped yeps, he hung up.
Fuck, those fucking birds. Callahan's bitching about the shit all over the cement again.
My mother's birds. Large cages on the apartment's roof housed about 20 different birds, pigeons and sparrows mostly. Our neighbor Winnie, a friend of my mom's who lived down the hall from us, had offered to care for them after Mom passed. She wasn't always good about cleaning up after them. I'm sorry, it's been a busy week. I'll clean it.
It's all right. She wants me to check her kitchen sink, too, I guess.
In addition to working at the auto shop up the street, Connor had been appointed the unofficial fixer for the apartment complex, for which we got a $100 break on rent.
Be right back,
he said, and set his beer on the counter before slipping past me. Seemed like the widow Callahan had been calling him frequently lately, and I'd have had to have been comatose not to see something was going on between them. Not that I cared, except that I hated being left alone with Angelo. Once gone, Angelo lit up, the scent of cheap cigarettes filling the room. There's no smoking in here. The corner of his lips curved upward in a sickeningly sly grin.
Come put it out. I dare you.
Rolling my eyes, I stepped past him toward the sink for a glass of water, seeing as my throat had suddenly gone bone dry. I would have gone straight to my room, but I was afraid he'd follow me there. It was better to be closer to the kitchen knives. Why are you here this late? I glanced back, and catching him looking at my ass, a wave of acid climbed to my throat. I tipped back the glass of water, drowning the urge to call him out on it.
Little lily cat,
he said, ignoring my question.
You're not so little anymore, are you, kitten?
Don't call me that.
Why does it bother you? You got a boyfriend or something?
The sound of his chuckle when I didn't answer him grated on my nerves.
No, of course you don't have a boyfriend. Men are dicks, right?
Pretty much.
You ever touch one before? A dick, that is.
Shaking my head, I set the glass on the sink. I'd officially surpassed my patience level. When I turned to leave, though, he was standing behind me, caging me against the counter.
Pretty girl like you. Seems like you'd have touched a whole lot of dicks by now.
I pushed off the sink to step past him. but he pressed his body against me, sending off alarms in my head. Let me go, you fucking freak. I gritted past clenched teeth and wriggled my arm from his grasp. Sharp nailed fingers gouged my throat and I froze, grinding my teeth in anger as he leaned into me as if he'd dare kiss me. Eyes riveted on my lips, he smiled, his breath reeking of beer and cigarettes.
Sometimes I imagine your blood all over my cock, and it makes me hard.
Cold black eyes shifted from my lips to my eyes, the smile on his face fading.
Does it bother you when I say that?
I bit the inside of my cheek to steady the trembling of my jaw. The guy scared the shit out of me, but I refused to admit that to him. Something told me he got off on fear. The knife. The knife sat in my pocket, but as badly as I shook, I'd have probably dropped the damn thing before I even got to cut him with it. If you don't let me go, right now, I'll fucking scream.
I'll fucking scream,
he mocked.
So? Scream. You think anyone in this neighborhood gives a shit?
He took a drag of his cigarette and blew it in my face. Lips sealed, I twisted as much as his grip would allow, refusing to breathe it in.
If it weren't for me, your old man would be drowning in bills right now. It's me who keeps your sister in that fucking quack school, and who keeps you from having to sell your pretty little kitty ass on the streets to pay for college.
After my mother had died, B's mental health deteriorated rapidly. She'd sank into the kind of depression that had me checking on her throughout the night and calling the school during the day. My therapist had suggested a boarding school, Bright Horizons, centered around mental health, and offered to evaluate her for admission. B had passed with flying colors and even managed to get a small bit of financial assistance to cover some of the cost for her tuition. Connor and I split the rest, an unwilling contribution on his part, seeing as he thought mental illness was a bunch of bullshit. The asshole actually had the nerve to say that to me once, and I swore it took a stampede of willpower not to haul off and smack him. I couldn't risk his anger, though. I needed him to cover part of her tuition, so pissing him off wasn't an option. It was the reason I stayed in the cramped apartment over the theater, working a shit night job and taking the bare minimum classes each semester at community college. And dealing with Angelo, of course. You'd better not be roping us into the cartel. Bold words on my part, and I regretted them the moment I'd said them. Teeth bared, he squeezed my throat harder, the pressure amplifying the rapid pulse in my neck. Not enough to completely close off my windpipe, just enough to scare the shit out of me that he could have.
You think you're so fucking smart, don't you? What promising little scientist scrubs shit stains in toilets? Huh? Huh?
I clawed at his fingers, refusing to let the gurgling fear show on my face. One palm still crushed my throat while his cigarette-toting hand gripped my wrist, and he glanced downward.
Memento mori,
he read from the tattoo on my forearm.
You're one of those dark bitches who fantasizes about death all the time. Is that it?
That wasn't it at all. In fact, the tattoo was a reminder of humility. But what did the dumbass know about that? Let me go. Angelo chuckled and released my jaw. Finally free of his grip, I skittered as far away from him as I could, my body still trembling from the encounter. He stamped his cigarette into my dilapidated slice of pizza, not that I'd have eaten it anyway, with my stomach roiling and acids burning my throat. Sneering back at me, he strode out of the room. Not a minute later, the door clicked, announcing his exit, and I let out an exhale. Keep it together. After tossing the pizza in the trash, I kept on toward my bedroom. Once inside, I slammed the door shut and pressed my forehead to the surface, letting the adrenaline from that fucked-up encounter with Angelo settle as I fought tears. I hated him. Hated that Connor trusted him around me. Hated how weak I felt in his presence, how vulnerable. Through deep breaths, I calmed the thrumming of my heart. He's gone. It's okay. On that note, I turned to my room, my sanctuary, brimming with books, candles, small apothecary jars filled with my favorite dried herbs and tissue salts, given to me by Glinda, the woman who owned the homeopathic store just up a block, a place I'd frequented when my mom had gotten sick. I dropped my bags beside my bed on the way to my closet, where I drew down a small trinket box from the top shelf. Cracking it open revealed a number of unrelated objects, small treasures I'd collected over the past couple of years. Bones of a long-dead sparrow, the bright red feather of a cardinal, which my mother had always told me was a gift from the angels, a squirrel's rib bone, and 6 of my baby teeth in a tiny corked bottle. Beneath all that sat a picture of me and my mother, from before her sickness had taken hold. One of Bee's barrettes with a yellow and white stone bumblebee, odd coins and rocks I'd collected, and a crystal Glinda had given me for protection. Inside the box, I deposited the rosary, then closed it up and set it back on my top shelf. From there, I kicked off my shoes and plopped down on my bed, exhausted. I needed to get some sleep. After all, I had a meeting with my professor first thing in the morning. 2 weeks ago, I'd written a paper for my microbiology class, a case study. Although meant to be fiction, the assignment was to come up with a fictional disease, and I'd taken the opportunity to write about my mother's illness. A purging of guilt, really, seeing as writing the events down helped me realize how screwed up it was that I'd been her main caregiver in those weeks before she'd died. She'd refused to see a doctor and remained adamant that I not take her to any hospital, no matter how bad it had gotten. Instead of detailing the suicide at the end, though, I wrote about the worms. Figured it wouldn't hurt, seeing as they didn't exist anyway. I referred to the disease in the paper as black worm syndrome, and apparently that delightful little case study had earned me a meeting with my professor first thing in the morning before class. I hadn't mentioned my mother's name in the study, hadn't referred to her as my mother either. She'd always been what I'd considered ruthlessly protective of her privacy. Still, even if I'd only been 16 at the time, I couldn't help but feel a small bit of blame for her rapid decline. For not insisting that she'd had it checked out when things had begun to worsen and she'd begun seeing things that weren't there. Especially if it could have saved her in the end. Across the room, over my makeshift desk of stacked wooden crates and plywood, hung a picture my mother had painted years before she'd gotten sick. A scenic cliffside seascape with an ancient-looking oak whose curved branches held a small swing. It had always brought me a sense of peace. Such a faraway place from the shitty apartment in the shitty city. I'd asked her once if she'd ever been there before. In a dream, she'd said. A somber ache bloomed in my chest as I plucked a picture pinned to the wall beside my bed. Of my mom, me, and Bee, taken about 2 years before my mom got sick. My mother had always had a radiance about her, but even more so that day, as the sun shone down through the almost burgundy locks of her hair. She'd possessed the beauty of an untamed flame, destructive and wild. My whole life, I'd been told that I was a spitting image of her. I'd never had the chance to be wild and untamed, though. Always felt more like the flame in those electric fireplaces, a fake contained by glass, without much potential to do anything. Life had shackled me the moment she'd gotten sick, and somehow I just couldn't break from those chains. While Bee had inherited some of her traits, too, she seemed to have gotten a lot more of Connor's features. Where mine and my mother's eyes were bright bluish-green, hers were hazel like her father's. Unlike Bee, I'd never met my father. According to my mother, he was a deadbeat, so I never had much interest. Also different to me, over Bee's right eye was a bump, a dermoid cyst that she'd been born with, one that had been a source of insecurity for her since she was old enough to attend school, where her asshole classmates had poked fun at it. Unfortunately, my mother had never been able to afford to have it removed, so it still deformed her eye a bit, though she didn't seem quite as troubled about it these days. As I stared down at my small but broken family, a snaking dread twisted and writhed inside of me. Help me. Mama, no. Distant screams echoed through my thoughts, and eyes squeezed shut, I shook my head. No, don't look at it. Don't look. The blackness seeped back into the corner of my mind, and I exhaled a shaky breath, opening my eyes again. A slight tremble in my hand shook the picture as I slowed my breathing. Relax. It's gone. I pinned the photo back to my wall, and from beneath the bed fetched out one of the black restraints I kept hidden there, a literal BDSM wrist restraint that I'd had to buy at a sex toy shop a while back. After securing one end to the metal frame of my bed, I paused for a moment, making sure Angelo hadn't decided to return for more harassment. Nothing but the quiet sounds of the apartment, the hum of the air conditioning unit in the living room window, the cars down Prather Street, and muffled music from the theater below filled the small room. Reassured, I tucked my pocket knife beneath my pillow and secured the restraint's other end to my wrist. Just Velcro, so if necessary, I could release myself quickly. It was about the only effective thing to keep me from sleepwalking, even if it might not have been the safest. I'd tried the medication route once, but without insurance, that was no longer an option. And given the number of times I'd found myself standing outside of the apartment, I figured I needed to do something. As strange as it may have been, the restraint worked, and I only had to do one side, as the tugging and clanking against the metal usually woke me up. Good thing, too. I had a feeling I was in for a restless night. Chapter 4. Lilia. Professor Wilkins sat across from me, his eyes stern and unreadable as always. Unlike those of my other professors, his office boasted a rich quality with burgundy leather chairs, a thick cherry wood desk with matching credenza, natural light lamps, and bookshelves behind him. The room matched the guy's personality, as he was probably the only professor I knew at Covington Community College who wore a bow tie every day and talked like something out of an old Cary Grant movie. After a moment of straightening a few scattered papers on his desk, he entwined his fingers and looked up at me.
Miss Vespertine, about the paper you wrote.
A sharp sting across my bottom lip reminded me to stop biting it, a bad habit I'd picked up to avoid biting my nails. Sir, may I? Am I in trouble for something? I just want to get that out of the way first, rip the Band-Aid off, so to speak. He leaned back in his chair, eyeing me for a moment.
No, you are most certainly not in trouble.
Exhaling an easier breath, I unclutched the chair handles I'd been clawing at. Oh, that's a relief.
The paper you wrote, Miss Vespertine, it was quite engaging. Fascinating with all the detail. You seem to have exceptional insight into the fictional organism you wrote about. These worms that you described sound terrifying.
I closed my eyes to a flashback of those worms slipping out of my mother's mouth in the vision I'd had the night before. All night long, I'd suffered horrible nightmares of seeing them crawling over the floors and out of mouths. I suppose I have quite an imagination.
I'm curious as to what happened to the individual that you cared for in the paper.
What do you mean, sir?
Well, you never included their fate in the summary at the end. Only the course of the disease, the progression of it, and your observations.
Fingers steepled together, he eased back in his chair, his eyes brimming with concern. Well, I suppose, given the fact that I hadn't offered a cure for it, I didn't care to mention her fate.
And why didn't you craft a cure?
I shrugged, clearing my throat. The assignment was simply to write a fictional disease and its impact on human physiology.
Which you did brilliantly. So brilliantly that I feel compelled to ask how you came about this particular disease.
Had someone else written the same thing? I didn't understand why he would have called a meeting to ask me these questions. I beg your pardon, sir. I made it up. You said that I wasn't in trouble, yet I feel like you're accusing me of something. The tension in his face softened to a slight chuckle, and he shook his head.
Forgive me. I am not accusing you, Miss Vespertine.
With a sigh, he stared back at me again.
The organism that you wrote about isn't fictional. While I understand there are thousands of parasites, the symptoms you described are quite telling of this particular species.
A beat of shock pulsed inside my chest, and my mind spun backward, replaying his words. What did you just say? I asked with a weak voice.
I said the organism described in your paper is not fictional. It exists.
It exists. Real? Not made up in my head. No, that couldn't be right. Are you joking? Lips flat, he shook his head.
I would not have called a meeting based on a joke.
Except that it had to be. For years, I'd been told that it was a figment of my imagination, was led to believe that what I'd seen had been skewed by the trauma of my mother's suicide. It had taken time, but I came to accept the explanation. The lie my head had told to protect my heart, because my mother's suicide made little sense otherwise. She'd loved Bea and me too much to let herself decline that way, to end her life so gruesomely. Everything unraveled inside me, snapping away like fragile branches that had grounded me to some truth. The news was somehow both validating and terrifying at the same time.
You won't find it in any textbooks or online searches.
Professor Wilkins interrupted the maelstrom of thoughts in my head.
Well, that's because the research is ongoing and happens to be privately owned.
Privately owned? It seems to me that something capable of infecting another human being should be made public.
I'll come back to that in a moment.
He lifted a stack of papers from beside him, and I just caught the title of my case study that he'd printed off.
After reading your paper, I submitted it to a colleague of mine for review. Her name is Loretta Gilchrist. She's the entomology professor and department chair for the College of Natural Science at Drucadia University. You're familiar with the school?
The overpriced, yuppie university that I'd half-heartedly applied to the summer before my senior year, when I'd hoped to one day become a lawyer, even though I knew damned well I wouldn't be accepted. Yeah, I knew of it. And of course, I'd been rejected. Good thing, too, because it was later that I'd made the decision to switch majors and find the cure for the perplexing disease that had ravaged my mother. Yes, I've heard of it. Law school, right?
They do have a law school, yes, but they're far more renowned for medical research.
Well, I mean, they're a little out of my league, so I suppose it makes sense that I didn't know that.
They're very selective about their applicants. The school, as you know, is quite prestigious. A number of prominent individuals have walked the halls of Drucadia.
He rolled his shoulders back, a look of pride coloring his expression.
It happens to be my alma mater.
As much as I wanted to ask why, if that was the case, he was teaching a general microbiology class at community college, I kept my lip zipped.
As I suspected, Dr. Gilchrist was also quite impressed.
He reached into his desk and withdrew a black envelope, which he handed to me.
She apparently shared your paper with the Dean of Admissions, Dr. Langmore, who asked me to pass this along to you.
Frowning, I accepted the unaddressed envelope and turned it over to see it had been sealed with gold wax stamped with an Old English D. What is this?
It's for you. Open it.
The usual austerity that had given him the reputation of being a jerk twisted into something completely out of character for him. The man wore a giddy smile, and the sparkle of excitement in his eyes had me both curious and concerned. I broke the wax seal to find another black envelope inside, that one addressed to me in beautiful gold calligraphy. Opening that envelope revealed thick parchment, folded at perfect thirds. A stamped seal marked the top of the page with the same English D as on the wax.
Dear Miss Vespertine, on behalf of Drucadia University, I'm pleased to offer you admission into the College of Natural Science. Our university prides itself on academic excellence and groundbreaking medical research. We believe your credentials, along with Dr. Wilkins' personal endorsement, makes you a perfect fit for our undergraduate program. In accordance with the academic scholarship we've awarded for fall semester, all expenses will be covered for travel, textbooks, and housing. Should you choose to accept this invitation, the midnight train at Covington Park will provide transportation to the port city of Thresher Bay, Maine. You will then take the ferry to Drucadia Island. Matriculation is contingent on successful completion of your registration. I encourage you to sign into your student account, which I have taken the liberty of setting up for you, to begin registering for fall classes. And as a reminder, classes will begin on the 1st of September. Due to the competitive nature of our admissions, we ask that you contact us at your earliest convenience with your decision. I am available at the email address and or telephone number listed below with any questions or concerns you might have. I'm very much looking forward to hearing from you. Warm regards, Gilbert Langmore, Dean of Admissions, langmoreg at drucadia.edu. Office, 555-721-3699.
I stared down at the letter, the confusion probably scribbled across my face as I read bits of it a second time. I don't understand. I was denied admission, and I mean rightly so, it's way out of my league. This doesn't make any sense.
You applied for their medical science program before?
No. I originally planned to go into law back then, changed my mind.
Well, it seems they've reconsidered also. While I certainly didn't expect my discussion with Dr. Gilchrist to result in admission, I will say, academically, you do possess the aptitude, Miss Vespergine. Make no mistake about your qualifications.
A strange enthusiasm carried on his words, which somehow failed to stir me. I appreciate that, but this letter is offering one semester. There's no way I can afford a school like this. I can barely afford Covington's tuition.
One semester with the opportunity to continue. The school prides itself on retention and academic success. I suspect they'll evaluate at the end of the semester and make a new offer.
Still holding the letter in one hand, I rubbed the tension pulling at the back of my neck. Forgive me, I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but receiving an acceptance letter this way just feels unofficial. The excitement in his expression dulled to earnestness.
Given the fact that you, yourself, did not apply, perhaps Dr. Langmore felt that, had he sent it to your home, it may not have been taken seriously.
It was true. Had I received some fancy invitation like that at home to a school that had previously rejected my admission, I'd have probably thought it was a scam and tossed it.
Understand, Miss Vespertine, that between researchers and those wishing to pursue medical careers in particular, Dracadia receives upward of 30,000 applications every year. Their acceptance rate is 2.5%, well below Yale, Harvard, Stanford, Princeton. That's less than 1,000 students.
I understood the math. If I had applied to the school myself for medical science, my chances of getting in without Wilkins' referral were exceptionally slim. Probably impossible. This university, it's actually located on Dracadia? A small island off the coast of Maine, if my geography was right.
It is, yes.
I rubbed harder at my neck. That's over 3 hours away.
I believe your scholarship includes dormitory expenses and travel.
Another scan of the letter confirmed the inclusion of housing and travel. Dracadia was one of those locations that, like Martha's Vineyard, I'd always assumed to be a summer vacation spot for the wealthy. The cost for even one semester at the university must have been ridiculous, a thought that continued to make the invite a little hard to swallow. How did they acquire my recent transcripts? My test scores?
As a private entity, they are under no obligation to review each candidate by the usual standards. They could offer you a scholarship merely because they like your name. And believe me, that happens.
For a school that prides itself on retention and academic success, that doesn't seem wise. Giving a slight huff, he nodded.
I understand your apprehension, and perhaps disbelief. Allow me to circle back to your question regarding the organism and research. It's Dracadia that owns the research, Miss Vespertine. The organism in question is called Noctosoma. It's a parasite that exists predominantly on the island and rarely infects humans. We're just not a very reliable host, and not all physicians are aware of the organism as a human pathogen, which is why it's interesting to me that you know so much about this, considering that it's almost never diagnosed outside of Dracadia.
Not a typical human pathogen. Perhaps it's just coincidence.
I don't think so. The way you described them expelling from the subject's mouth is fairly indicative, as I understand from Dr. Gilchrist. At the beginning of the year, you told me that you were interested in finding the cure for what took your mother's life. Were those not your exact words during introduction?
They were. I guessed I hadn't realized he'd made a mental note of them.
I didn't want to pry into what had ailed her. However, if the patient in your case study is truly your mother, surely you wouldn't pass up the opportunity to attend the only university authorized to study this particular parasite. Even if only for a semester. Aren't the answers to your questions worth it?
Yes, they were. My whole life I'd wanted answers. Answers that doctors and specialists I'd made a point to contact on my own hadn't provided.
What makes this organism capable of infecting humans?
Evolution, of course. But it requires a vehicle of transmission. Admittedly, I am not well-versed enough on this parasite to know the how of it, but there is a Noctosoma expert at Dracadia, Professor Bramwell. He teaches neuroparasitology and gross anatomy, and is board-certified in anatomical and forensic pathology. He's also the one who performs autopsies for those suspected of Noctosoma.
Bramwell. I made a mental note of that. It was my paper that decided admission?
I'd be willing to bet on it. As I said, it was quite impressive, and demonstrates the breadth of your understanding. Of a number of topics, really. Parasitology as well as physiology and research.
He pushed up from his chair and grabbed a photo from the bookshelf behind him. He stared at it a moment before placing it on the desk. On it, a much younger version of him stood before an aging stone building, with pointed spires that reminded me of Notre Dame Cathedral.
I can tell you from personal experience, once you attend Dracadia, you will not want to leave.
The worms existed. Not in my head. Real. And there was a university that specialized in studying them. The possibility just seemed impossible. A dream that had tapped into the most unsettling memories and thoughts and conjured something completely outrageous, like an Ivy League school extending an invitation to a girl who could barely afford the bus fare to get there. Can I think about it?
Of course. But first semester starts after Labor Day. I wouldn't take too much time. As I said, these positions are few and rare.
A peculiar, inexplicably nostalgic warmth settled over me as I stared at the picture again. I understand. And thank you, Professor. I appreciate your confidence. Chapter 5. Lilia. I should have been studying for my online physics exam. Definitely not Googling Dracadia University, especially since it wasn't a possibility for me. Being at a university that far away with a full-time schedule would mean not being able to cover half of B's tuition. Not only that, but Connor would definitely freak out if I told him I couldn't cover my share of the rent anymore. He'd undoubtedly throw B's tuition in my face and pull her right out of Bright Horizons. Clicking on the images of the university hurt, though. Nestled on an island, the school had once been an old monastery for clergymen, a place predominantly built for religious study. While it appeared that a few newer buildings had been added to the campus, it maintained the same overall look of the Gothic academic architecture seen at old schools like Harvard and Yale. The enormous building I'd seen in Professor Wilkins' picture sat on a steep cliff, as if the foundation itself had been built into the rock formation. It looked to be centuries old, with its lichen-covered stones and intricately carved masonry rarely seen nowadays. A stone wall separated the campus from the surrounding woods, and what looked like a small town sat in the foothills of the cliff. The campus reminded me of something out of Dead Poets Society, rich with tradition, opportunity, a dream. One too far out of reach for me. For kicks, though, I entered the admissions address into the search bar and logged in with the temporary credentials provided to me in the letter. There on the screen was an account already set up for me, just as Dean Langmore had mentioned. A profile lacking an image, but a number sequence had been assigned, and all of my general information had already been populated. Below my name, a button to register for classes taunted me to click it. I checked the URL again against the one I'd Googled. Everything seemed legit. Unfortunately, I had too much on my plate. With a sigh, I clicked out of the search and eased back into my chair, staring up at the painting of the tree and the swing and the vast ocean beyond it. Somehow it captured my sense of longing right then. "I wish you were here, Mama," I whispered to myself. "I could really use your advice right now." When I wasn't occasionally spotting ghostly visions of her, I'd sometimes hear her in my head. That soft-spoken voice which cracked any time she tried to yell at me and B. I smiled at the memory of laughing whenever she'd gotten mad at us, and that gentle voice